I'm going to call this this meeting of the Senate Committee on Health Care and Human Services to order for February 8th, 2013. No, February 14th. What does it say, February? Oh, okay, that was when it's posted. Never mind. February 4th. Oh, I should have known that.
Yeah.
But now that I'm a single person, Valentine's Day isn't as important as it used to be.
Oh, listen to this.
That's a good thing in this case, okay? Okay.
Baby.
I want to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 362 and invite Senator Rosenbaum to the dais.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. And for the record, my name is Diane Rosenbaum. I'm the state senator for District 21, and I'm here today to introduce Senate Bill 362, which is a bill about saving lives of people that are sitting in this room, people that are sitting at this witness table, and I think people that are close to all of you. And Senator Cruz, before I start, I just want to say that you have lots of friends and admirers, and 48 of them, along with you, are signed on as sponsors of Senate Bill 362. So I think it's a great way to celebrate Valentine's Day together to kick off the hearing about this bill. So Senate Bill 362 is a bill which provides an opportunity to do more screening for breast and cervical cancer for low-income women who qualify for an existing state program called the Breast and Cervical Cancer Program. That program is familiar, I think, to members of the committee who've been here in past sessions, because we've dealt with it a lot. I think that people on the committee and in the room certainly know that we have a huge unmet need for screening for breast and cervical cancer. And in fact, today we know that we have approximately 77,000 women who are eligible for this program, but it's only funded to serve approximately 5,200 of those 77,000 who are eligible. And just to put a personal face on this a little, I think many of you know that I myself was diagnosed with breast cancer back in early 2005 and was treated and didn't actually deal with this program at the time, but was lucky enough, like many people, to have great insurance and to be able to get an early diagnosis and treatment. But this program deals with the fact that so many women are not that lucky. And so this is an opportunity, a federally funded program, to provide mammography and screening and get early diagnosis for women who are not otherwise able to get it through their insurance because they just don't have that insurance. I think you probably also know that the state of Oregon has one of the highest rates of breast cancer incidence in the country, and we know, and Senator Steiner Hayward, because she does this in the rest of her life, well knows that when we get breast cancer early and when we diagnose cervical cancer early, we know that it is very survivable. And these are diseases where we can really do a lot to save lives and ultimately to save money. So that's why it's just crucial to be able to do what we can to make sure that women get in for these life-saving screenings. And so the bill before you, if you look at it, you'll see that it has a blank in it. It's one of those bills that will need ultimately to go to the Ways and Means Committee to be considered along with other important priorities. But I would just urge you to look at this bill today, and you will be hearing later in the hearing from the Komen Foundation that has done a huge amount to raise funds and provide the state match for this program, where we are required to provide a $1 for every $3 of federal funds. Those funds have come almost exclusively from funds raised by the Komen Foundation. What we are trying to do is find a way to prioritize putting some general fund money for that 1-3 match so that we can increase the number of screenings that we do. So you'll be hearing from survivors, you'll be hearing from the Komen Foundation, you'll be hearing from the agency that administers the program about how this works and the good that we can do. I think you will also hear from the agency that there's a dash one technical amendment to just reword the bill so that it does what we intended it to do. So I wish I could stay with you further. I have to be elsewhere, but I know the bill is in good hands. I know that the sponsors are, a lot of them are sitting right here today. And so I'll just leave you with the wish that we can send this bill expeditiously with the due pass and get it on its way so that we can do a lot for ourselves, our sisters, our wives, our mothers, our daughters, all the people that are going to benefit from an improvement in this program. So thank you very much, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Well, I just want to say thank you, Senator. I don't think we can move the bill today because the paperwork hasn't caught up.
We're watching it closely.
We're hoping. We'll wait. You know, we can do it maybe by the end of the day. This is easy paperwork because it's got another committee to go to. I want to say, you know, for the record, the Komen Foundation is very big in my community at our cancer center. And, in fact, this summer I allowed myself to be publicly embarrassed in one of their bra auctions. So... which is a long story, and we won't go into that now. But
a good plan.
But I've always been a supporter of preventative measures, and after my experience of the last year, I'm an even greater supporter now. So this is good stuff, Senator.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Senator Rosenbaum, just clarify one thing, and we've talked about this a little bit, but I want to bring it up because I think it's important. The current language of the bill talks about the 77,000 women. And one of the questions that came up in the Women's Health and Wellness Alliance, for which this is a top priority this year, is what's that number going to look like after January 1st of 2014? Wouldn't we expect that this program wouldn't actually be necessary? But in fact, I have very good estimates from the Oregon Health, from OHA, that in fact, even after January 1st of 2014, we will still have at least 25,000 women who will be eligible for this program and who will not have appropriate health insurance to cover this very important screening. So in case anybody has any questions about whether this will still be necessary, I just want to point out that it's very clear that it will still be necessary even after January 1st of 2014. So we really appreciate your bringing this forward and encouraging full funding.
Great. Thank you very much for your comment and for hearing the bill.
Okay. For now, I'm going to temporarily close the public hearing on Senate Bill 362 and open the public hearing on Senate Bill 172. Senator Bates.
Thank you, Chair Cruz and members of the committee. I first want to thank you for letting me go first, and I want to apologize to those in the audience, especially those with children, for letting me go first. I've got a four-hour drive, and frankly, if I'm not in Asheville by 7:30, I might as well just keep going to Reading and spend the night there because my Valentine's waiting there for me. I better show up in time. And I also like to point out that two of the most eligible bachelors of state have been streamed live here today. One is Senator Cruz, and the other is a young man back here who I think is a cute-looking guy and probably could get a date tonight without much trouble. Senate Bill 172 talks about something that I actually have a little trouble wrapping arms around at first, because when I first saw the bill, I didn't understand.
Would you give us your name?
Senator Bates? Alan Bates, for the record, District 3 down in Southern Oregon. I had a hard time wrapping myself around the bill at first because I didn't understand why this wasn't being done automatically. In my hospital, for the last 25 or 30 years, we do a routine, what we call oximetry, on all newborns, and we're screening them for congenital heart defects and lung defects also at the same time. So we put these little things on their fingers and on their toes because we want to check both ends to make sure there's no obstructions to heart outflow, basically. It was brought to my attention that only about half the hospitals and newborns in the state are screened that way at birth, and that was pretty shocking. It leads to situations where heart defects that you really can't detect well at birth, you can't hear, you wouldn't have to do an ultrasound on everybody, are missed, and some of these kids go home and die suddenly and unexpectedly. And so this bill just simply says, as a mandate, you will check everybody. These oximeter machines are cheap. We've got one in our office. We use it 4, 5, 6, 7 times a day for other purposes, for adults and others. It's practically costless to do this. Just takes a few minutes. There's absolutely no reason that this shouldn't be done. I'm sorry it takes a mandate to do so, but if it's, that's what it takes, that's what it takes. And I love the entertainment. Cute kid. So I'd entertain any questions at this point. I think you don't get many slam dunks in this business. This is a slam dunk. I don't see any reason anyone would be opposed to it.
You know, I would say over the last decade, the amount of newborn screenings we're doing has given us so many benefits, it's beyond belief.
And amazing.
Yeah.
Senator,
yeah.
What he said.
Okay.
As the other family physician in the room. It astonished me to find out that it wasn't being done routinely, because it's basically free. Because every unit that delivers babies has these, anybody that delivers babies has one of these units on their unit delivery already, and it's a question of sticking on a kid's finger for all of about 35 seconds. So.
I know people doing home deliveries that have this.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just basic.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Don, I was going to move a bunch of bills, but now she's back. So. Thank you for bringing this forward. It's nice when we catch these things that should be common sense.
I would ask you to move this bill immediately. Thank you very much.
I think we need. Oh, I think we probably can.
Well, we need. There's other.
There may be others who want to speak to it.
We'll wait. We'll have an actual hearing on it first. Okay.
That's all these complications. I know. But thank you.
Have a safe drive, my friend.
I will.
Okay.
Thank you.
At that point, I'm going to temporarily close the public hearing on Senate Bill 172 and turn the gavel back over.
You know where
okay,
we're supposed to go.
Okay. I'll now open a work session on Senate Bill 107 and hand the gavel back to the chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Vice Chair, for helping me out on this. Sandy, will you bring us up to date on where we are at with that?
Yes, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 107, we had a public hearing on the 5th last week. You'll recall this relates to the Oregon Health Licensing Agency allowing the nursing home administrators. I'm not going to list them all. I apologize.
They all
have some technical fixes that are included in the bill that the agency reviewed for us. We now have the paperwork in front of us. We needed a -1 amendment that took out the language, the Educational Service Board. The agency found out that board is no longer in existence. So we just kind of like took that out.
Fewer boards, more better.
Right. So everything's good. We have a no fiscal impact, no revenue impact on the -1. And if the committee so chooses, it's ready to go.
Madam Chair, I move the -1 amendment to Senate Bill 107.
Senator Cruz moves the -1 amendment to Senate Bill 107. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 107 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 107 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator
Hayward?
Aye.
Senator
Knope?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Oh, no.
Aye.
I think
she's going to say aye. Aye. Motion carries.
Knope.
Okay. Senator Knope is going to be carrying this one because Senator Cruz and Senator Steiner want him to. Okay, with that, I will close the work session on Senate Bill 107. And do we go to
just go to public hearing?
Okay, now I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 210. Sandy, can you give us an update on this?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 210, you are the primary sponsor, Madam Chair. This authorizes certified registered nurse anesthetists to deliver certain services without medical collaboration in connection with the procedures performed in a location where medical, surgical, or dental services are rendered other than ambulatory surgical centers or hospitals. We do have the paperwork. There's no fiscal, no revenue impact on this bill, Madam Chair, and we have some folks who want to testify.
Okay, I would like to call Judy Weiss and up. Come forward. And colleagues, currently certified nurse anesthetists specify guidelines for how the nurse anesthetists are to follow when practicing in an ambulatory surgical center and hospital, but is silent on office practice settings. And so so this is addressing that issue to see if we just need to, it isn't expanding the scope, it's just providing a level playing field all across the jurisdiction on where they practice, so.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee for your time today. My name is Christina Cowgill, and I am a certified registered nurse anesthetist, and since that's a mouthful, I'll just say I'm a CRNA. I currently serve as the Director of Government Relations for the Oregon Association of Nurse Anesthetists, another mouthful, so I'll just say ARANA. ARANA is the professional association for CRNAs in Oregon. CRNAs are anesthesia providers, although different in training from our anesthesiologist colleagues, we can clinically care for patients in the same safe manner. We have over 320 nurse anesthetists, or CRNAs, in practice in Oregon. For some perspective for the committee members here, there's approximately one nurse anesthetist for every two anesthesiologists in the state of Oregon. CRNAs are abundant in numbers, and we are proven safe anesthesia providers. More than half of our CRNA members practice in the metropolitan Portland area. OHSU and Kaiser Health Services have large anesthesia departments that employ over 50 nurse anesthetists. The Providence Health System uses CRNAs as the forefront of obstetrical anesthesia, even in high-risk obstetrical cases. My goal today is just to provide you with a few tidbits about CRNA education, provide a few tidbits about the current practice in our state, and then just give you a push to pass Senate Bill 210 out of committee today. First, on the education, I want to say that any experienced nurse who has critical care experience can become a nurse anesthetist, but it is key that they have this extensive pharmacology and life support techniques that are mandatory to do this role before applying for a program. Nurse anesthetists are master's degree prepared, and they do a 24 to 36 month residency where they will do all types of anesthesia during that time. During a residency, they are required to do a minimum of 550 anesthesia cases. These cases would be, for example, neurological cases, cardiac, ear, nose, and throat, obstetrics, and all the way from geriatrics to pediatrics. We know from looking at our graduates that most of the CRNAs graduate with far more than that required minimum of 550. Most have at least 850 cases before they graduate, and that's the equivalent of about 1,700 hours of anesthesia. In Oregon here, we also have a rich history of training nurse anesthetists, and St. Vincent Hospital in Portland started training nurse anesthetists in 1909. Currently, CRNAs are trained at OHSU, and we train in Oregon approximately 30 CRNAs per year. Second is the practice of nurse anesthesia in the state of Oregon. It is essential for nurse anesthesia to be present in Oregon. As I mentioned before, half of our members work in the greater Portland area, but that leaves approximately 40% that uphold the rural part of this state. Nurse anesthetists are the sole anesthesia providers in many of our rural and critical access hospitals and our rural settings in Oregon. These communities that depend only on CRNAs for anesthesia are communities like Astoria, Seaside, Lincoln City, Reedsport, Coos Bay, Bandon, Grants Pass, Redmond, Pineville, Hermiston, Enterprise. As you can see, quite a large portion of the state, and I haven't even gone through all the areas. So you should have quickly learned that CRNAs have provided an essential anesthesia service to this state for many years. Over 100 years to be exact. Here's a history book about the history of anesthesia in Oregon, and a large percentage of this book is dedicated to the role that CRNAs have played in the state. So when we decided to look at our statute, we realized that there was some silence about office anesthesia. The office arena, as you well know, because of transformation in healthcare, many of the costs are looking to be driven down. So these surgeries, especially minor surgeries, are taking place in the office. Physicians who do these surgeries are going to continue to support this model, and we have seen a drastic increase of the number of office surgeries that are required. So there's two options. A patient could do the more costly route, or they can do this in the office and have it safely secured by a nurse anesthetist. The Oregon Medical Board adopted rules pertaining to office practice in 2005. Nurse anesthetists are recognized in these rules and have been practicing since then without any question of those rules. CRNAs practicing in offices are also held to the American Association of Nurse Anesthetists Standards of Care for All Patients in All Settings, including the office-based practice. And this association has been in the forefront of establishing clinical practice standards, including patient monitoring standards in the office setting. Oregon is well positioned, as you know, to be the nation's leader in healthcare transformation. CRNAs have always been a key component of anesthesia services throughout the state. Clarification needs to occur that CRNAs can indeed practice in these settings at which they have been practicing in. So I urge you today to please pass Senate Bill 210 out of committee. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Good afternoon, Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee. My name is Julie Wise, and I am an attorney. I practice with the law firm Hagelin Kelly in Portland. And my firm has been working with the Oregon Association of Nurse Anesthetists, or ARANA, for about 15 years, and shortly after the passage of the 1997 CRNA statute. This actually is my first opportunity to offer testimony before a committee, and I'm honored to be here, particularly because this committee is so involved in healthcare reform. And we really respect the work that you are doing, and thank you for that. Like the CRNAs sitting next to me, I urge you to support Senate Bill 210 and to pass it out of committee. As Christy Cowgill indicated, this really is a housekeeping measure. Senate Bill 210 would codify office practice of CRNAs. And the way this came about, as I've indicated in the written testimony that has been provided to you, in late 2012, we learned that the structure of the statute was such that some people actually questioned whether it authorized the practice of CRNAs in the office setting. That was very surprising to us because CRNAs practice in the office setting before the passage of the statute in 1997, and of course they continued to do so afterwards. Not only was it surprising to us, but it also was very disconcerting and concerning to us because we feared that that would potentially limit Oregonians' access to health care, particularly in the rural setting, and increase costs, as has previously been testified to. So really, out of concern for Oregonians' access to health care, we very quickly jumped on some legislation to codify office practice and to fix what apparently was an ambiguity to some. Now, Senate Bill 210 is really very good public policy, and I don't think I need to tell all of you that allowing advanced practice registered nurses and also nurses in general to practice to the fullest extent of their scope is good public policy. It's integral to health care reform. It is consistent with everywhere we are going in the state of Oregon. And the data also supports this. There is an Institute of Medicine 2010 report that found that expanding the role of nurses in our nation's healthcare system is going to help us meet that growing demand for medical services. And the Advanced Practice Registered Nurses, or APRNs, like the Certified Registered Nurse Anesthetists, are part of that effort. Now, I want to touch very briefly on patient safety. To the extent anyone is concerned about patient safety, you need not be. And we do, in fact, have a report that is in your packet, No Harm Found When Nurse Anesthetists Work Without Supervision by Physicians. And what I'd like you to take from that is that this was a landmark national study, examined nearly 500,000 individual cases of anesthesia. And the report found, not surprisingly, that there are no differences in patient patient outcome when that anesthesia is provided either by a certified registered nurse anesthetist versus an anesthesiologist versus a certified registered nurse anesthetist supervised by an anesthesiologist. So safety should not be a concern. That report is in your packets. And the other key document that I would refer you to is the 1998 opinion of Kim Cobrain, who was then the AAG advising the Board of Nursing. So this is contemporaneous with passage of the bill back in 1997. And she makes clear that the bill was not intended to limit the settings in which CRNAs could practice. Really, CRNAs practice to the fullest extent of their education, training, and competencies, and the location is irrelevant to that. So thank you. We urge you to support Senate Bill 210 and pass it out of committee.
And thank you very much. You did great for your first time. Awesome.
Thank you.
Come back again.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. My name is Michael Ray. I'm a certified registered nurse anesthetist as well. And I just briefly wanted to touch on, to give this a little bit of a personal touch in terms of share with you my practice and how I am. I think my colleagues Julie Wise here and Christy have outlined our education and where we're at. So I'm currently, as I say, been practicing in the state of Oregon for over 15 years as a CRNA here. I've been working in Washington County, Yamhill County, Clapstop County, Hood River County, out at the Coast Hospital. And I've worked in both hospital and office-based settings in these practices. In hospital-based settings, I'm caring for very acutely ill patients without an anesthesiologist. You know, we're dealing with some of the sickest patients in both obstetrical units where you have to worry about both mother and fetus and stuff to be delivered, and we are doing just fine in terms of our safety record. When I also practice in the office settings, we are, as indicated, most of these procedures are minor surgical procedure with our healthiest patients that we're seeing that come by. One of our standards of accreditation is to evaluate patients before they come. Patients that are too sick to have a procedure done in a hospital, neither the surgeon nor anesthesia wants to do them in that settings because there typically aren't the resources that are there. So we're typically seeing our very healthy patients in these settings that we're working at and what we're seeing and how we're doing. So to give as an example of what I'm working with, one of the office clinics that I'm working with over the past year, it's a women's health clinic that they have, and they have a group of over 90 physicians, and they see a large number of women that they come into there. They have actually partnered with the Healthcare Improvement, or the Institute for Healthcare Improvement, who has came across with a triple aim approach to healthcare. And what they're looking at trying to do is three things that they want to see: that there's an improvement in the overall experience of care for patients, so that you're getting a high level of patient satisfaction through their care; that we're seeing an improvement of the healthcare population, and one of the ways is increasing the access to care for people; and finally, of course, that we're seeing improved healthcare costs that's happening. So, for example, in this one setting, you're seeing women that are often have a relationship with their obstetricians over a number of years that they're seeing and getting mammograms, you know, their annual exams, things like that done. Should they find that they need a surgical procedure done, it's much more comfortable for those women to come into the physician's office and have the minor procedure done and have some degree of anesthesia provided with them. The obstetrician is able to focus on their part, and we're bringing anesthesia in, we're able to look over the overall care of the patient. So you've created a very positive impact for the women who are coming in, and they are much more satisfied to have these procedures in the office than going through the hospital setting. Secondly, patients are more likely to go to the office settings rather than hospital, just because it is simpler, so we've increased access to care in that settings. And finally, our third point to, you know, finalize this triple aim approach that they've come across is in 2012, my partner and I have seen at this one clinic have done over 200 cases in that settings. When we compared insurer premiums of the similar procedures done in a hospital setting versus where we were done in the office setting, we saved over $1 million just in this clinic alone in terms of insured healthcare costs. So clearly there's the evidence there that these office procedures are saving healthcare dollars for all of us in this reform. If we are not doing these procedures are going to be moved back into the hospital and the costs are going to go up dramatically for it. So I think as my colleagues have outlined the educational preparation, we have a strong track record, we have a strong history of being here, and I really believe today that this Senate bill that we've got before us here today is just trying to codify our existing practice. We are not asking for any further increase in the scope of practice from what we're doing, and we just want to codify what we're doing. So again, I would ask for your support for this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions? Thank you very much, panel.
I would like to call up Frank. Is it Palmanese?
It is Palmer's.
Palmer's. Sorry.
I've been called worse.
Palm Rose.
Sorry.
Your apologies are not necessary. My name is Dr. Frank Palmrose. I'm a practicing anesthesiologist at St. Vincent's Hospital in Portland, Oregon. And I've been a lifelong Oregonian, born and raised here in the state in Astoria in southern Oregon. I've been practicing now in anesthesia for the last 22 years. I have worked with Kaiser, with nurse anesthetists, at both their obstetrician floor up at St. V's, and then now I'm full-time with OAG, which is a all-physician group. So that gives you a little background. I've seen both sides of the fence and things. I'm going to be very brief. My colleagues are quite elegant in announcing that their training and their scope of practice and things, and I really have to say that it really boils down to that the reason the hospitals and ASCs are more expensive is there are safety concerns. We have a level of safety and certification that the office practice cannot match. There are issues about safety in the office as well. The OMA has actually started a certification program to look at office-based anesthesia and to come up with some standards and to certify these offices to make sure they're safe. So safety is one of my biggest concerns. We're talking about giving some deep anesthesia for possibly more invasive procedures with the potential for fluid shifts and possible bad outcomes. Safety is primary in these situations. As far as going to rural hospitals and the possibility of anesthesiologists there, the issue there has been pretty much financial. There has been the rural pass-through law that we have been trying to change for years that would allow some Part B dollars to be transferred to pay for anesthesiologists at these critical access hospitals, and that has failed. So financially, there's a disincentive for anesthesiologists to practice at these rural hospitals. The other side of the coin is training. You know, I really believe this is an advance in their scope of practice. You know, they really are becoming pretty much independent practitioners in the state. At the time of Senate Bill 412 back in the late 90s, my understanding was that it was a compromise bill and that they would not seek advanced privileges other than in rural hospitals and in those situations where there was not an anesthesiologist available. This is really an advance in that, really. At this time, I have really not much more to say. Like I say, I like to keep things short, brief. Brevity is the soul of wit. I will take any questions or concerns you may have.
Okay. Are there any questions? No questions. I think we've been pretty well versed on this. All right.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And I don't have anyone else to testify on this. All right. Yes, we have the fiscal impact, which is no expenditure impact and no revenue impact. So I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 210 and open a work session on Senate Bill 210.
Madam Chair, I'll move Senate Bill 210 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 210 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? I appreciate Dr. Palmrose's testimony, and we're not dismissing that at all. I had to go under anesthesia at the Oregon Clinic in November, and I wanted to know who was doing the anesthesia, and I said, what are you, a nurse anesthetist or an anesthesiologist? He said, nurse anesthetist. And I started, before I fell asleep, asking him about his work, and he had been doing it for 36 years. Is that possible?
Yep.
Yeah, 36 years, and I...
You're alive.
I'm alive. but he did share the types of anesthesiology and the types of patients, and they are very, very well trained and very well versed. That's all I have to say. Anyone? Okay. If there's no further discussion, the clerk will call the roll.
Senator Steiner Newman?
Aye.
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries, and I will carry the bill, and I will close the work session on Senate Bill 210. With that, I would like to, which bill are the children?
284.
If you don't mind, in deference to the young kids, I would like to move to 284. And so I would like to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 284. And it looks like
We have the Wilsons.
Is there a structure of who should go first? Okay, well, is it Tammy Wilson?
And her husband, David.
And David Wilson?
Another one.
Go ahead.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 284 comes from Senator Boquist. It's directing the Oregon Health Authority to adopt rules requiring that all infants born in the state to be screened for lysosomal storage disorders. This has an emergency clause effective on passage. This does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. We do have a fiscal impact on this, and there is no revenue impact, and there are no amendments.
All right. Well, thank you very much for having us, and I want to say thank you to the audience for allowing us to go before your bill as well. I appreciate it. I just want to first and foremost say, Senator Boquist.
Oh, you have to state your name
for
the record.
Oh, I'm sorry. Tammy Wilson. I'm a resident of Yamhill County, Dayton, Oregon. And do you want us all to state first our names and then go forth?
No, you go ahead.
The reason why we're before you, we went to Senator Boquist and House Representative Jim Widener as well as Johnson and asked them to look into passing a bill to expand newborn screening, more so to test for all newborn children to be tested for Krabbe's disease. This particular screening offers testing for a total of 6 lysosomal disorders, Pompe, Fabry, Goucher, and some other ones, and a new one was just added to that. So this screening offers a total testing of 6 disorders. And we formed a awareness group called Marshall's Mob after my son Marshall. So just, and then Hunter's Hope Foundation also helps us carry out awareness through the state of Oregon. And that's, of course, why we're here today. I have a total of 5 children. And my 2 oldest, which is my daughter Melanie, who you may hear a little bit later, and my son Mason are both older children. Our 3rd child being Marshall, we had an excellent pregnancy, born natural with no issues whatsoever, even met all of his milestones through his infant and baby stage. At 12 months of age, we were ready for him to walk. At 13 months of age, we actually saw him not want to take his first steps. And at that point, we knew something was wrong, so we started the normal guidelines of seeing our pediatrician, being referred to Dornbecker, and so on and so forth. So several months of testing led to an official diagnosis of Krabbe's disease, which is a genetic disorder. At the time, I was already pregnant with our 4th child. We adopted one, my nephew, but our 4th biological child, I was already pregnant with. So as Marshall continues to regress in everything, he is now, he's losing his motor skills, he's losing his ability to eat by mouth, and now, you know, we're now looking at a G-tube surgery, a gastric surgery, so that he can be fed receive all of his nutrition. When he received his diagnosis in 2011, we had Michael, and we were encouraged to have him tested. And at 2 months of age, he also tested positive for this disease. The reason why I'm encouraging newborn screening is because, without going into too much tears, the last 2 years I have seen my son pretty much regress back to a vegetation state, lose all of his milestones. My son is blind and deaf. He has seizures. He has to be fed by a G-tube. And he continues to regress to the point to where his brainstem will no longer function with his body. Till his heart can no longer beat and he can no longer breathe on his own. He spends most of his time on oxygen. If newborn screening had detected this at birth,
It could have saved his life, and I know that because my son Michael was tested positive with Krabbe's disease. And 2 months later, he received a cord blood transplant at Dornbecker. He's now 2.5 years old and walking. And so I'm asking the state of Oregon to test for Krabbe's disease, along with the 5-6 other disorders that are available for this one particular screening, because it can save lives. I have a picture with me, Brody. He died just 2 short days after Michael received his cord blood transplant. He was also born here in Oregon. His family couldn't be here today with us because they couldn't make arrangements, but they wanted to be here. They're huge advocates of newborn screening for Krabbe's disease. And their son, again, just died shortly at 3 years of age. He just turned 3 years old 2 days after Michael had received his cord blood transplant. And then we have a third family here who you will actually meet. And it's also my understanding that there are other families. We don't know exactly how many, because some choose to remain private. And I understand that it's a very deadly illness, and it really takes a hold of your family and creates hardship and burden. But don't get me wrong, it's a true blessing to have him in my life. And I just think it's vital to know that if Marshall had been tested, he could have potentially had the same outcome as my other son. So I appreciate you hearing from me. If you have any questions or if you want to speak to the other individuals. It's a very short version of the story, by the way.
Well, thank you so much for your testimony. And my heart goes out to you. And yes, the newborn screenings are so important, and if we can do this, we'll see what we can do.
That would be great.
State your name. So my name is David Wilson. I'm the father of all these kids here. You know, you guys are seeing Michael here running around, destroying everything, having a lot of fun, being a typical two-year-old. At our house, we classify him as an F5 tornado with the terrible twos coming on. And a lot of times.
And see, he just gave us a huge smile when his father said that.
This guy is always on the go. We really believe, actually, that he is trying to play for his brother Marshall. And even though that these two are born apart from each other, they both have treat each other like they're twins. I mean, these kids have had a lot of time together inside of hospital beds at the same time. And Michael here, he lets us know whenever anything's going on with Marshall, whether he's having a seizure or stretching or whatever he might be doing at that time. But, you know, yeah, a lot of this comes down to the medical side of it and everything. We are connected with several hundred families from around the world that are people that like to talk about their experiences with Krabbe's disease. And some of the big things that happens with all this is a lot of people are financially strapped with this whole thing. It's more expensive to take care of him in the state than it is to do the cord blood transplant. And not only that, several of these families that we know throughout the country and the world, this disease usually destroys the family relationship. There's been many families that have had divorces because of it. So it's more of just the newborn screening. We're talking the lives of families down the road and everything. Marshall here, he's 24/7 care. Tammy and I, we tag team with it. Our living room set up with a hospital bed, a bunch of equipment, and we take turns every night who sleeps on the couch so we can take care of him, because if he starts coughing, we immediately have to take care of him right then, deal with seizures, all that kind of stuff. So we're always tired. So it's important for us to do this. It's very important. It's a good legacy for Marshall. Marshall's already saved his brother, Michael, wherever he might be trampling around at. And, you know, we want him to save other babies, too. This is something that can be taken care of, can be treated. Even some of those other diseases that are included in this, like Pompe, they have gene therapy going on to allow those children to live a long life. So this little guy back here, he has a good chance of seeing retirement. This little guy right here, based on the last time we saw the specialist, he has actually outlived what they expected for him to live. He's on borrowed time right now. They didn't actually expect to see him this last year in December when we went and seen him. We already know that the brainstem for him is greatly affected. We can see it between how his body reacts to the seizures, the way he breathes, just the way his oxygen perforation is. We can see, those of you that are in the medical field, you guys all know the list of signs of what a person will develop when they're dying, and he's received most of those on that list. So, you know, he turns 4 in June. We really hope he makes it to that, but we also realize that there's a very good chance that he won't. So,
such a sad story. Thank you so much for sharing your experience with us. And we do have to look. And I know, I think, hopefully there's research going on.
There is.
Yes. So that we can develop a test and...
Right now, state of New York and state of Missouri has actually been testing already. New York's been testing, I think, for 3 or 4 years now. Missouri just started this summer. And there's a few other states that are online to start the testing.
Yes, Dr. Steiner Hayward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, to the Wilson family, thank you. I choke up easy. And, you know, I'm an Ashkenazi Jew, and we have lots of storage disorders that affect our community as well. So I've seen friends and families close to us deal with other versions of this. And so I have some small sense, both from my patients and from my community about what you all must be going through. And we really appreciate the effort you've made to come and share your story and point out the importance of this testing. And second, on a much more pragmatic note, and I don't expect the Wilson family to be able to answer this, I know there'll be a fiscal on this and it'll cost the state a certain amount of money. I'd be very interested to know how much it would save the state for biennium for every kid that we catch. It's not that cord blood transplants are cheap, but caring for Marshall is not cheap either. And not only in terms of the actual economic effects, but the effects on the families and friends of children with these storage disorders. And it'd be interesting to see if we could get data from New York, for example, where they've been doing this for a few years, about their experience with the impact on their state health programs and on the families who've been affected by these diseases, because those are the kinds of things we should be considering, not just the upfront cost of the testing, but the true cost to society for children who are not caught early, and not just on the actual medical expenses, but on the families themselves. I can't imagine it's easy for you sometimes, with your parents giving wonderful attention to your younger brother, but I don't know how old you are, probably 12, 13?
Almost 12.
Could you introduce yourself? Put the microphone there and please introduce yourself.
Well, I'm Eleni. I'm the oldest of the kids, and this is pretty hard for everyone in the family, especially mom and dad. They don't get enough sleep, and we don't get to have we don't get to go out on fun trips, because it takes us about an hour and a half just to load up everyone. and it's just really hard for everything. And concentrate or going on all night. And just everything is really hard for... And knowing that some kids can... Like, sometimes we know about kids dying each day. So, because... 1 week we had 5 kids die, so it's really hard.
Well, thank you so very much for testifying.
What she's talking about there is the Crab Aid group that we belong to. We know that just a couple weeks ago, from a Sunday to the following Monday, we had four kids pass away, all due to respiratory infections. And right after that, Marshall went in the hospital for pneumonia. And, you know, it's been a bad year so far for a lot of these kids, but that's what she was referring to.
Okay.
Senator Steiner, on the cost of some of this, we do know that the actual test for these diseases is $1 per test. The expense mostly is the initial equipment to do the testing. And one thing that we learned about recently is that we believe that Oregon is kind of a regional lab for other states to do some of the PKU testing. Mm-hmm. That New Mexico didn't pass to test for Krabbe's disease because of the fact Oregon didn't have the equipment. So we believe that some other states may be coming online as long as Oregon started it. And California didn't do it because of the fact that they couldn't afford to buy the equipment, because everybody knows California's broken.
He's going into a seizure.
No, he's just leaning forward trying to get some attention.
I think he's trying to testify.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, up front there's going to be some cost to get the equipment online, the extra staffing or whatever needs to happen to get that going. But my guess is once that happens, shortly afterwards, we're going to probably have New Mexico, probably California, and then maybe some of the other states will come online also.
That's very useful information. Thank you, Mr. Wilson.
Yeah,
yes.
Madam Chair, President Courtney and I, a long time ago, passed the PKU screening bill. And I think Oregon does a lot of PKU screening for a lot of other states. And by the way, interestingly enough, my nephew has two PKU kids. Without that screening, they'd have entirely different lives than they have now. So,
any other testimony from this family? Thank you so much for your testimony. And with that, I would like to call Randy and Kathy Frazier from Jefferson.
You.
Thank you very much. And thanks for bringing Michael, too. He's a real
Absolutely.
Joy. Don't worry about him.
Well,
he's doing
you know,
great.
The thing is you got Michael that got the screening, and this guy didn't.
Yeah.
That's the difference.
Yeah, I think so. I know. I don't believe this fiscal. I'm going to try to believe this fiscal.
I'm going to come
in. You have it in your pack.
I've had some talks.
Okay.
My name is Kathy Frazier, and we're from Jefferson County. We came over the hill this morning because this is important. This is my son, Christopher. Christopher was born in 1976. I was 18. He looked like a nice, healthy little boy in this picture. He was 2 months old. And he seemed like a nice, healthy young boy until right about this time, when he was 6 months old, he started kind of regressing a little bit. But I just, you know, if you ignore it long enough, it'll go away. If you say it out loud, it becomes real. And so one day my mom said, we need to go see the doctor. There's something wrong with Christopher. And my doctor didn't. He said, yeah, there's something wrong, but I don't know what it is. You need to go see a specialist. And he sent us to Bend. And she said, well, there's something wrong, but either I can keep doing the tests here, or you can go straight to the med school in Portland, which is where I have to send everything to be tested anyway. So we went to the med school, to Dornbecker's. And they ran some tests on him, and they had to send up to Seattle to find out what it was, that it was Krabbe. And they didn't tell me much about it. All they can remember him saying was that it's hereditary, it's very rare, there's no hope. Your baby's dying and there's nothing we can do about it. And so they said you have two choices. There's a hospital here in Portland that specializes in taking care of terminal kids, or you can take him home. And I chose to take him home. I also chose to give him his body when he died so they could find out about this, something about this disease. They gave me no hope of ever meeting anybody with this disease or meeting another parent that had children with this disease. They told me that Christopher was the fifth case that the med school had ever seen with this disease, the eighth case in the history of the state of Oregon. Nobody ever lived beyond 2 years with this disease. Christopher lived to be 11 months and 12 days old. And then two huge events happened. One was I saw this movie. Nick Nolte starred in this movie, and I liked Nick Nolte. So I wanted to see this movie. It's called Lorenzo's Oil. You know. I didn't know what it was really about. But I did know this little boy was dying from the same thing that killed my son, even though there were some differences. His came from his mother only, and he was much older than my son. But I knew this was the disease that killed my son. So I started searching some more. And then we came up with this wonderful thing like that called the Internet. And finally, I found the United Leukodystrophy Foundation. And they, through them I found Hunter's Hope. And through them I found Kathleen Scott. And through them I found the Wilsons. And finally, last year, for the first time ever, I met another family who had a Krabbe's kid. I got to meet another Krabbe's kid. This was something I never had any hope of doing in the 70s. And now you can test a child at birth and find out, and you can save these babies. Mm-hmm. So why would you do anything else? I would love to not have to worry over my great-grandchildren being born with this. I cried over both of my grandchildren because I was so scared that I might have to tell my son, youngest son, that, gee, baby, the same thing that killed your big brother is going to kill your babies. I don't want to have to do that with my great-grandkids. So if you can test for it and do something, why would you do anything else?
Again, thank you so very much.
Thank you for listening.
Okay, comments, questions? I've done a little homework on this, and evidently the secretary of the DHHS at the federal level, there's a process, and they nominate and review all of these various disorders, and this has been rejected two times at the federal level, and we need a rational process, and I found out that New York has had it, and it's had mixed results, because there's really no approved method. I know that public health has told me that at this point in time, they don't have a capacity to develop a test, but what I don't want this bill to go to Ways and Means and die. I want to be proactive in trying to deal with this. And so I talked with Senator Boquist, and he says, let us direct public health. It means delaying it, but have an amendment to this bill that directs the public health to look at this disease, look at the administrative review process, look at the possibility of developing a test, and then report back to us so that we can go forward. So in talking with Senator Boquist, we feel is a much more proactive. It means delaying this, because at this point in time, the fiscal that the health division, they would have to develop the test. They would, their projection is $15 a test, but you're saying New York's is $1 for the test. And so all of these things we want to work out so that we can come up with a plan to deal with this. Okay. Yes, Senator Cruz.
Yeah, the simple thing for us to do here would be to say we love this and send it to Ways and Means, and then nothing happens. We don't want to do that. I would also suggest, Madam Chair, I would like to get an opinion from OHSU on what they think. I think they're the experts in this, and I would like them to weigh in on this. So yep. I think Senator Steiner Hayward can help us with making that happen.
I'll work with Ms. Gilly-Circa to do that. And
Yeah.
Okay. I really think we want to be able to, if I may, Madam Chair.
Yes, please.
We want to be able to make a compelling case, not only the very clear emotional, and I mean that in the best sense of the word, emotional case for this, but, as I said earlier, a very clear fiscal case, because unfortunately, for better or for worse, we live, well, money doesn't grow on trees, right? And we want to help families like yours. We want to prevent these kinds of problems from affecting other families, and we want to be able to make a very compelling case. And as Senator Cruz said, if we pass this out of committee right now, it'll go, I'm on the Health and Human Services subcommittee that it would come to for Ways and Means, and I can tell you it would go nowhere. It probably wouldn't even get heard. And that's not what you all deserve. You all and your children deserve better than that. You deserve to have this taken very seriously. They are. And that's why we take this very, very seriously. And so please understand, we are not going to let this fall off our radars. Okay? We are not going to let this fall off our radars. You can hold us accountable for bringing this back in the future, and we will do our homework. We will come back to you and say, here's where we're going. But I don't think it's going to go through the way you hope it will go through this year. But we're taking this very, very seriously.
Okay, we'll be back.
Good.
And I want you to know, sometimes it takes two or three sessions for us to get a good bill through, but we want it to go through right.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much. Thank you so much.
I just want a better explanation, just a kind of a rundown of exactly what steps you're wanting to take. Just very passionate and strong about this, so.
And just reintroduce yourself.
Tammy Wilson. I'm a resident of Oregon.
If I could.
Yes.
So again, my question was, I just wanted a better understanding of the how you want to proceed with this.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What I said, you know, just sending this bill to Ways and Means probably won't get any of us where we want to go. What we need at this point in time, and you know, the chair wants to talk to the public health folks, and which is appropriate. I am suggesting we talk to OHSU, which is where the real certified smart folks, in my opinion, are, you included, and where the research happens. And what we need at this point in time is to get an idea from the experts in the field the best way to proceed to make this happen. And that's, you know, because we don't know. And you know, the one thing, all of us up here, I mean, we're just normal folks like you guys, and if you're smart, you know what you don't know, and you ask the people that do, and that's what we're going to attempt to do on this.
And what we want is a process for the
for getting there.
Yeah. And we can't just pass it now, because we need to have the buy-in from the agency who will be performing these tests or developing these tests. And we do have to develop these tests. And there may be a good test that will be developed within 2 years.
And when you say develop tests, what are you referring to? Because there's already a screening for this test.
Yes, and the information I've gotten is the tests have mixed results. And so, again, we need more information from what's happening in New York, and of course we don't have enough from what other state did you say just start?
Missouri.
So it's in its infancy.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I mean, I understand where you're coming from, and I understand that we want to have a concrete proposal as we pursue. That way, we don't have any steps backwards, and I get that. I just also want to clarify that yes, New York is testing for it. As far as mixed results, I'm not sure what that is, because I know there's mixed results with every single testing, mm-hmm. even the ones that we're currently doing now. I do know the testing, the screening itself, costs $1, and it tests for a total of 6 disorders. And those all combined aren't so rare when you look at all 6 of them.
Mm-hmm.
I also know the Oregon Health Authority is very neutral on this. I also know Hunter's Hope is a huge advocate at the federal level, and the only reason why it was denied a couple of times is because they didn't get all of their ducks in a row. They had all their information, but they didn't have it at the presentation at the time. But they're looking for it to be very successful the next go-around. And then, of course, again, Hunter Soap is a huge advocate. They could answer the majority of your questions, both on the Fiscal level as well as New York's results. And I know Missouri is going to start testing right away, and there's several other states that have actually passed a test. As my husband mentioned earlier, it was my understanding that New Mexico had passed, but because Oregon is a regional lab for them, they can't pursue it because Oregon's not set up for it.
Thank you very much. And we're going to take all of that information and make this a better bill.
Absolutely. Understand.
Thank you so, again, thank you so very much.
Thank you for
listening. And I don't have anyone else to testify at this point. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I would like to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 284. And are there other children that we need for the next bill?
172.
So we should do that. Mm-hmm. So let's open a work session, a public hearing on Senate Bill 172. And Senator Bates has already testified on it. And so so let's
go down the list.
Let's start with Joanne Rogovoy, Jessica Adams, and James Love.
I think Jessica left the room.
Okay. So, Lace, Jim Lace. I'm sorry, I thought that was Love. It's Valentine's Day, so James Lace, Joanne Rogovoy, and Stephanie Tamasweet. Well, Joanne Rogovoy, and they said that Pat Sheehan's isn't in. Okay. So then Pat, Jessica Adams is not in?
I can speak on her behalf.
Oh, you're speaking on her behalf. Okay. So, and then James Lace. Yeah.
Chair Mona Sanderson and committee members, my name is Joanne Rogovoy, and I'm the State Director of Program Services for March of Dimes, Greater Oregon Chapter, and I'm here today to offer a March of Dimes perspective on screening all newborns in Oregon for critical congenital heart disease. This year marks the 75th anniversary of March of Dimes. Our mission is to improve the health of newborns by preventing birth defects, preterm birth, and infant mortality. And a special note, 2013 is also the 50th anniversary of newborn screening in this country. One of our organization's proudest accomplishments is our contribution to newborn screening through research, education, and advocacy. March of Dimes grantees developed many of the first screening tests that are still used today. In the 1960s, Oregon was a pioneer in leading the nation in newborn screening. We were the first state to mandate screening for PKU, along with Massachusetts. As part of our mission, we support screening for congenital conditions and disorders for which there is a documented medical benefit to the affected infant from early detection and treatment. There's a reliable screening test for the disorder, and early detection can be made through a specific means, whether a blood spot or, in this case, pulse oximetry. As such, the March of Dimes supports the addition of critical congenital heart disease to Oregon's newborn screening panel and supports Senate Bill 172. Critical congenital heart disease is a subset of congenital heart disease, and it's the most severest form of that disease. Of the congenital heart disease that is labeled critical, seven of those conditions can be reliably detected with pulse oximetry. 40,000 infants in the country are born with congenital heart disease. 4,800 of those will have critical congenital heart disease. And nearly 300 of those babies will leave the hospital undiagnosed. Screening with pulse oximetry for critical congenital heart disease is non-invasive. It's done before discharge. And one of the most important things for us is that studies have shown that screening with pulse oximetry for critical congenital heart disease, it has few It's very low with false positives. The rates in the big studies are 0.17% to 0.14% would be a false positive. The Secretary's Advisory Committee on Heritable Disorders in Newborns and Children is charged with advising the Secretary of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services in areas that are relevant to conditions in children, particularly newborn screening. And in September 2010, that advisory panel voted to recommend critical congenital heart disease be added to the nation's recommended uniform screening panel. The Secretary of Health and Human Services adopted that recommendation in 2011, and now it's up to the states to add that recommendation to their screening panel. Eight states have enacted legislation for screening for critical congenital heart disease: Connecticut, Indiana, New Hampshire, New Jersey, Maryland, Tennessee, West Virginia, and California, and nine other states have legislation pending. All types of the critical congenital heart disease have a medical or surgical intervention that can improve the health of newborns.
Thank you. Because there's so many to testify on this, I'd like to have you limit it to 2 minutes, if you can. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ellen Miller. I'm here to represent Providence Health Systems. One in every four babies born in the state of Oregon are born at a Providence facility. We currently run these tests, and we believe it's important to the health of all children in the state. We feel this is a good bill, and we support Senate Bill 172.
Wonderful. Thank you. Dr. Lace.
Okay. I'm Jim Lace. I'm a pediatrician here in Salem, Oregon. I represent the Oregon Medical Association and the Oregon Pediatric Society. Written testimony. I'll keep mine real brief. If anybody is not quite sure what we're talking about with how to do this, this is a simple O2 sat monitor. Ellen? Oops. So we put it on, and we turn it on. It's all from scratch. You know, we got to wait a second until it warms up.
And basically, it's measuring the O2 level.
It's measuring the oxygen saturation. So what this is a reflectance meter. It's bouncing off little white light waves at a certain frequency off the hemoglobin molecule, and it comes back with a color change. So the higher the oxygen, then you get a number that comes back. Oh, Ellen, 100%.
Mm-hmm. Yay!
You're an athlete. So, but look at your heart rate. It's too high. You're going to die. So, no. Anyway, so what it is, you saw how quickly that was, and we support this. There are many nurseries in the hospital in the state already doing this, and we'd like to pick up those other babies. I've been doing pediatrics for 36 years here, and I know I've sent babies home without having this test done. And I know that we can't look at a baby and say, oh, they're normal or not. If you can hear something, great. But if you're picking up some of these critical obstructive either cardiomyopathies or obstructive lesions involving aorta, you can't just look at them and pick that up. And so we know we miss those. And so this would help us and not have those babies go home to come back in a week or two either dying or dead. So we support it.
Thank you very much. Okay. Is it Pat?
Chair Mona Anderson.
Oh,
can I
yes.
make one comment? Mm-hmm. We have a parents that are here from farther than 100 miles.
Right.
Right.
So I had already called Pat Sheehan's, and then Lindsay Lahr, and Stephanie Tamasweet.
Madam Chair and committee, I'll be very brief because I think I'm preaching to the choir. My name's Pat Sheens. I'm a neonatal nurse practitioner for Legacy Health, and we also screen newborns for congenital heart disease screening using pulse oximetry. I just wanted to tell you a story about a baby who we had. As you've heard, it turns out that our eyes aren't as good as we'd hope about even measuring things like jaundice, looking at babies and knowing that they're jaundiced. Neither can we tell when some of them have lower oxygen saturations than normal. And in this case, it was a very healthy-looking baby who was getting ready to go home, and the pulse oximetry screening showed that the baby needed to have the further workup, which is an echo of the heart to see and look for congenital heart disease, which the baby had, and then was transferred and had surgery and did very well afterwards. And so this is basically to have a patient to operate on that's in better health than going home and coming back and having heart surgery, which is, you know, a big thing. So thank you very much.
Wonderful. Thank you.
My name is Lindsay Lair. I'm from Grants Pass, and I represent myself. I'm here because of my son, Caleb Lair. He was born on his due date, and he was deemed perfectly healthy. He looked fine and normal. He got a 9 out of 10 on his APGAR. He wasn't blue. There were no signs. They heard a small murmur in his heart, but most babies are born with murmurs. He was breathing fast, and so each doctor nurse that came in, we asked if they would look at him because he looked like he was breathing too fast, but they each gave me the new mom syndrome. It's just new mom. He was born at 10:30 in the morning, and at 2 o'clock that night, my husband and I had just gotten done filling out all the hospital's paperwork to be released at 10 o'clock the next morning. I couldn't sleep, so I asked a nurse if she could give me something to help me sleep. Since she was a new nurse, I thought I would ask her because I hadn't seen her yet, and she did a pulse ox test. This was the first time the pulse ox test was done. She couldn't get a reading on either leg. And on one arm, she barely was able to pick something up. And she thought the machine was defaulty. So she asked if I wanted her to take him into the NICU. And I said yes, because we were being released at 10 o'clock that morning. So she took him in there and found out, in fact, he wasn't getting oxygen from his neck down. So we're pushing for the pulse ox test because in the time that it took for him for it to be discovered, his heart, he had something called endofibroechocardioelastosis, I'm sorry, and that's where his heart had stretched and tore and was so huge that they said he's not going to make it. They assembled, we're from Grants Pass, they assembled a team from Medford to come get him. It took about 4 hours for them to come get him, and they really didn't think he would make it. They examined him in Medford, and they did an echo and EKG and sent it right up to Portland, where they said he needed emergency surgery. They had to sign a waiver because they didn't think that even the cabin pressure he could survive being flown there, and he went there and had emergency surgery. He's had 3 surgeries. The last one was October 1st, none of them to address he was born with aortic valve stenosis, and none of them were to address that yet. We were told twice that he wasn't going to make it. He was given 3 to 6 months to live, and he's 2.5 years old now, which is amazing. But we're pushing for this because in the time that it took for it to be discovered, the damage that was done was absolutely, it could have taken his life. It could still take his life. He was put on the heart transplant list twice, and that was just because of the damage that was done in the time that it wasn't discovered. So,
and if it had been discovered sooner,
he would have just needed an aortic valve replacement, instead of being put on the heart transplant list twice and being so close to death. His heart was working less than 10%. They said around 8% when they finally discovered it. And he wasn't, like I said, he wasn't blue. He didn't have any signs other than breathing fast and them hearing a murmur. That was the only thing. But they said the murmur sometimes can be so, it can be so hard to tell, for those nurses to tell that there's what's wrong with that sometimes, unless they're trained, they don't know that they're hearing something more serious than just a regular heart murmur. So the pulse ox test alerted them to that. And I'd also like to say that pulse ox, if a baby's oxygen is lower than 95, it also can alert them that there's something wrong with their lungs as well. So it helps on multiple levels.
Thank you. Thank you so much for coming and sharing your story, because I know you've come to talk to me about it earlier. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much, Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee. I'm Stephanie Thomas-Sweet, Director of Government Relations for the American Heart Association. I'll keep my comments very brief. We're here today. This is actually the last day of Critical Congenital Heart Defect Awareness Week. Governor Kitzhaber was kind enough to issue a proclamation for Oregon. We are strongly supportive of Senate Bill 172. Just a couple quick comments. I think you've heard from the experts much better than myself, but CHDs are the number one birth defect in the U.S. and the number one cause of death in the first year of life. So this is a major issue for the state of Oregon. About 300 to 350 babies are born each year with CHD, and 75 to 85 have critical congenital heart defects. So this test can identify those within the first hours of life and give them the treatment that they need. In September of 2011, Kathleen Sebelius, the U.S. Secretary for Health and Human Services, did endorse the screening for CCHD with the use of pulse oximetry, and it does screen for seven disorders. The costs are very cost-effective, $5 to $10 per infant. I believe that there's a fiscal on that as well, and many of the hospitals, about 60% from our understanding, are already doing this testing. So we are strongly supportive of the bill and of all hospitals doing this for all newborns in Oregon, and I'm happy to take any questions. Thanks.
Questions? None? Thank you so much.
Thank you
so much for coming. The last two are Tonya Wiseman and Patty O'Sullivan.
Good afternoon. I am Tonya Wiseman. I am residing in Marion County in Staten. Chair Mons Anderson, members of the committee, thank you. I don't like read statements, but my meter goes off in 10 minutes, and I know you want to keep this to three, so I'm going to whip through this really fast. I'm here on behalf of my daughter, Rachel. This is one of the few newborn pictures I have of her because all the rest of them look like this. She was born with a heart defect, which left her with no functioning left ventricle. Unlike most babies with her condition, she was not diagnosed via ultrasound prior to birth. We raised concerns about her symptoms while in the hospital, but were told they were in the range of normal. We took her home, but found ourselves back in the ER less than 24 hours later with a baby who was only minutes from taking her last breath. Herculean efforts were made to stabilize and then lifeguard her to Dornbecker Children's Hospital. She suffered massive injuries to her vital organs due to oxygen deprivation. Most who treated her that day expected that she wouldn't survive the night, but she in fact did and began the difficult 7-day battle in the ICU to recover enough not to go home, but just to be stable enough to endure open heart surgery. A simple pulse ox test wouldn't have changed her defect or the need for surgery, but it would have caused her to receive the treatment she desperately needed the day she was born. She would have been made comfortable and allowed to prepare for the first of what would be a 3-stage surgery process lasting over 4 years. Instead, the first 4 days of her life were spent slowly being suffocated. Am I not on? Oh, it's too loud. Sorry. I get that a lot. A newborn's first experiences should be filled with love and tranquility, and while we did love and nurture her, I have to wonder if that was overshadowed by the pain of her body slowly shutting down. The fact is that she was dying the moment she started breathing, and one little test could possibly have drastically changed that. The lack of an early diagnosis complicated her recovery both before and after surgery. This increased the length of her hospital stay and the amount of her bills. It also left her with some permanent brain damage, which has led to epilepsy and some learning and behavioral disabilities. I am, however, blessed beyond measure to tell you that she is one of the lucky ones, that despite all these obstacles and a long, hard fight, she is now a precocious, curious, exhausting, entertaining, compassionate, and joyful 11-year-old. We don't know how long her heart will function adequately in its current state, but we view every day as a gift. I had hoped to introduce her to you today, but she emphatically informed me she had much better things to do, namely her class Valentine's party, which she was not about to miss. So here I am, advocating for her and others like her who simply ask for a fair chance. If they must battle this monster that is heart disease, and some of them must, they only ask that we provide every weapon, every resource, every opportunity for them to not only survive, but to thrive. Because the truth of the matter is, ladies and gentlemen, there are approximately 6 babies born every week in Oregon with some form of CHD. Chances are a family's life has already been changed today, quite possibly just a few miles from here. And whose turn will it be tomorrow? Might it be one of yours? Might it be a family member or friend? I've heard people say, if I can just keep one person from going through what I did, then my efforts would be worthwhile, and frankly, it's not enough for me. We can do better. Someone once said that knowledge is power, but a man named Dale Carnegie, that name may sound familiar, said knowledge isn't power unless it's applied. What does it say about us if we fail to apply our knowledge to prevent what happened to Rachel from continuing to happen? Who among us can look at them and say it's not worth it? Please join us in our support of Senate Bill 172. We can give these kids the chance to be all that they were meant to be. Thank you for your consideration. And just for fun, You may recognize this guy. Rachel met him when signing into Proclamation 1 year, Congenital Heart Disease Awareness Day, so I just thought I'd share that with you. So thank you very much.
Oh, thank you so much. The personal stories are always so meaningful, so thank you so much for coming.
Madam Chair, I'd say her daughter's got her priorities right. Valentine's party is more important.
It is. Okay. For the record, my name is Patty O'Sullivan. I represent the Oregon Association of Hospital and Health Systems. I represent all 58 hospitals in the state of Oregon, and I'm here to happily support this bill. Most of our hospitals already do this. Some are just starting. Some have done it for a while, but there are some that don't routinely do a pulse ox test. But we are here to support this bill and know that it will save lives and save heartache and heartbreak, as well as health care costs, special ed costs, and family costs.
That's right. And emotional costs. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
I have no one else to signed up to testify.
The bill.
So I would like to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 172 and open a work session on Senate Bill 172.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 172 to the Senate floor with an emphatic do pass recommendation, and I emphasize emphatic.
Okay. Senator Cruz has moved emphatically Senate Bill 172 to the floor with a do pass recommendation. And Madam Chair, we do have the fiscal, which is indeterminate, basically.
Yes, and a no revenue.
And a no yes. revenue. Okay.
And I am the administrator.
And
you are the chair.
Oh, yeah. I know. You know that you were calling me administrator a couple of meetings ago. So
oh, I'm so
it's
sorry.
All right. That's all right.
All right. Interchangeable.
So is there any more discussion on this bill? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Hayward?
Aye.
Senator Knope?
Aye.
Senator Shield?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. Senator Bates will carry the
Absolutely.
Bill, and I close the work session on Senate Bill 172, and we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 362.
And we heard from
Sandy.
Senator Rosenbaum.
We already heard from Senator Rosenbaum.
This is the cervical and breast cancer screening.
And while Thomas Bruner, Michelle Dawson, and Dina Pedersen, please come up and you go ahead. Or you've already talked about the bill, right?
Well, not really. Yes.
Okay.
We know what it is.
Okay.
We've got a dash one, but we don't have a fiscal or revenue on this bill. But it has to go
no.
to the way it means.
You're going to send it.
You're going to send it ahead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Adopt the amendment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. Right. Right.
Because it's going to wait.
Right.
I wouldn't do it before, but
right.
I definitely would. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, committee members, I'm Thomas Bruner. I'm the CEO of Susan G. Komen for the Cure, Oregon and Southwest Washington. And I have some great news for you. In the last several decades, we have reduced deaths from breast cancer by almost one-third. And another bit of good news is that when detected early, five-year survival rates for breast cancer are as high as 98%. That's the good news. The bad news is that 77,000 women in this state need breast and cervical cancer screening services. And between federal money and Komen money, we will reach about 5,200 of them. So in the last decade or so, donors to Susan G. Komen have actually provided almost $6 million to this state program, and in some years serving as the federally required match to pull down the federal funds. We're going to continue to be your partner in this program, but we're here to ask the state to pony up and become a partner with us as well. So I thank you for your consideration and encourage your passing SB 362 on to Ways and Means expeditiously. Thank you for having us today.
Thank you for coming.
You bet.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Michelle Dawson, and I'm from Portland, Oregon.
I sit here in this chair living, thriving, and breathing for two reasons. One of them is a very forward-thinking doctor who, when I went to see her, I told her my insurance was ending, and she said, okay, you're 35, let's get your baseline mammogram. So we did that. I ended up having cancer in the duct, which is only detectable through mammogram. Had I waited till I got insurance again or I turned 40, I don't know that I would be sitting in this chair living or breathing. So of the 19 phone calls I made to get insurance, because by the time I got my diagnosis, my insurance had expired, Komen, Oregon was one of the calls. They got me enrolled in the breast and cervical cancer program, and I had the best doctors, I think, in the world. And my experience was life-changing for all intents and purposes. So anytime I can stand up and shout from the rafters about the breast and cervical cancer program, I do, and I hope that the state will support this bill also. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, Committee. My name is Dina Peterson. I'm from Eugene, Oregon, where the hippies roam free. And at 38,
we're working on a bill on that one.
True statement.
At 38 years old, in 2010, I was the mother of six children. My youngest was 18 months old, and I had a lump in my breast. And as an uninsured woman in Eugene, Oregon, you shove it to the back of your mind, you put it to the side. You cannot afford health care, you cannot afford insurance, you cannot afford a simple doctor's appointment. My husband was living and working in Alaska. He'd gone 2 years unemployed. The only place he could find a job was out of the state. That left me with six children at home by myself, caring 24 hours a day for both of his ill parents. All through the summer that year, I just put it off in the back of my mind, ignored all of the signs and symptoms. At one point, I did make some phone calls and found out that my thoughts were correct. I couldn't afford to go to the doctor. By August, I was out in the garden, and I bent over to lift up a large piece of wood, and a bug landed on my chest, and I looked down to make sure it wasn't a bee. And all I could see was this huge, rippled, wrinkled lump and a sunken in part of my breast. And I immediately thought, this cannot be good. So I dropped the wood and I ran into the house and I thought, who can I call? What do I do? Like, there's no direction. We don't know what to do. So I thought, well, I'm going to call my OBGYN. She's delivered both of my babies, given me medical attention. I'll see what she says. She said, I want to see you in my office in 30 minutes. Don't worry about bringing money. Just get here. So I did. And she felt the lump and everything. The next day I was in a mammogram. Within 40 minutes of walking in the doors of Oregon Imaging, I was told you have a 99.9% chance that you have cancer and it's already progressed. That was terrifying. I was all alone. No insurance. Six kids to take care of? How do you do that? So the patient navigator came and got me and put me in her office, called my husband in Alaska and said, you have to quit your job and come home right now. And he did. Now we have no income, and I have no medical care, and I have cancer. She then picked up the phone, made three phone calls, and then she said, you are now part of the BCCP program. I didn't know what that meant. So she explained it to me. The BCC program allowed me to receive the medical care that I needed, as well as the collaborative care that people don't even know is in the background for a cancer patient. I was able to receive the medical care that I needed, chemo and radiation, a full year. The nutritional help that I needed to maintain my health and so that the chemo didn't take me out completely and the radiation didn't deplete me of energy completely. The mental health of the stress of not knowing if I was going to live or die and see my children grow up and be a grandmother, which is happening in April. The social services programs that they provide you without even asking. They don't wait for you to say, I need help. They just send somebody. They call me. They knock on my door. They're at the doctor's office. They just know. When chemo wreaked havoc on my teeth, I've always had great teeth, and I had terrible teeth pain, and it was from the chemo. They didn't say, oh, I'm sorry, you've maxed out your limits. They said, go to the dentist. There was no question about it. After I was done with my treatments, 3 months after I was done with my treatments, my arm started swelling up. My hand started swelling up. Ends up I have lymphedema. No sign of it prior to that. So now I'm in a lymphedema specialist, and I'm doing lymphedema treatment. No questions asked. They said, just go get it done. You need this. This is for your health. This is for your survival. The BCC program saved my life. It allowed me to be the person I am today and be the voice that I can be for breast cancer awareness. I would not have been able to seek the medical care after I was diagnosed in that mammogram if it weren't for the BCC program.
Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. And it's so exciting to see you here. And as a public health nurse, I actually supervised the BCC program in Clackamas County.
Nice.
And we did a lot of screenings, and we were always able to find some agency or provider to take care of our patients, and that is so, so very important.
Yes, thank you.
Dr. Steiner, hey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, thank you. It's never easy to talk about your personal medical history and your willingness to share your story and point out the importance of these programs. And here you are today, productive members of our community, able to be engaged with your families and your community, and it's really great. On a personal note, I'll just say it, the first time I spent any significant time in this building, I've only been a senator for about 13 months now, and the first time I spent time in this building was in 2005. Ms. Brown Miller, Senator Monis Anderson, and I spent a boatload of time together passing legislation to improve breast cancer screening. It's what I do, a big part of my life when I'm not here in Salem. I'm a family doctor, and I specialize in breast cancer early detection. So this holds deep personal meaning for me because it's a big part of my professional life, and it's always good to hear stories like yours that point out the importance of these programs to make sure that we save women like you and get you the care you need as quickly as possible. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Any other further questions?
Well, I'm just gonna say the only difference I'd have with Michelle is that my cancer doctor, I think, was the best in the world.
So. You had very different cancers, Senator.
Let's just say maybe hers is the best for her kind of cancer and yours is the best for your kind of cancer.
Thank you very much. Bruce Gutelius? I don't know if I said that right. Okay.
Senator Monis Anderson, members of the committee, thank you very much for having me here today. For the record, my name is Dr. Bruce Gutelius. I am the interim center administrator for the Center for Prevention and Health Promotion at the Oregon Public Health Division. And I'm here to offer information on the breast and cervical cancer program through the Oregon Health Authority in relation to Senate Bill 362. As you've heard previously, there are a number of important statistics that people have shared in regard to breast cancer in the state of Oregon. I think it's important to know that we have one of the five highest rates of new breast cancer diagnoses in the country in Oregon, and that one in five women in Oregon aged 21 to 65 have not had a Pap test within the past 3 years. Excuse me. Early breast and cervical cancer screening has been proven to save lives, as you've heard, as women with breast cancer have a 5-year survival rate of between 98 and 99% if it's caught at stage 1, and that drops to about 23% if it's caught at stage 4. So early detection is definitely key. Another key element is insurance, as we know that uninsured women are more than twice as likely to receive a late-stage breast cancer diagnosis by comparison to women with insurance. And finally, when cervical cancer is found early, it's highly treatable, often curable, and associated with long-term survival and good quality of life. In regard to the program specifically, the BCCP provides breast and cervical cancer screening services to Oregon's medically underserved individuals through a statewide network of clinical providers. As you've heard previously, the program is funded by grants from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and from the Susan G. Komen for the Cure, Oregon and Southwest Washington affiliate. And that funding has been really essential in terms of getting the state federal match that we need to get. Those state funds have been very important for us. Currently, that match is solely met by the Komen funding and by BCC provider write-offs, and there are no state funds that are currently invested in the program. As you've also heard earlier today, there are approximately 77,000 women in Oregon who meet the eligibility requirements for BCCP, and in regard to the effect that the Affordable Care Act will have on eligibility for the BCC program, our estimate is that there will still be around 26,000 people who are eligible for the BCC program, even after more people are covered through health insurance exchanges, CCOs, and Medicaid expansion in 2014. At the current time, the BCC program is able to serve approximately 5,200 people per year with available grant funding. So there are still thousands of low-income women in Oregon who go without the opportunity to be screened for breast and cervical cancer. As was also previously mentioned, as the bill is currently written, we don't have a definite number as to the increase in the number of people who would be screened, but I know that's to be clarified later. Also, in regard to the -1 amendment, I wanted to make sure it's clear that the Oregon Health Authority was trying to clarify that the BCC program does not actually provide breast and cancer cervical screening, but provides the funding to allow clinical providers to provide it. So in closing, I will say that cancer is one of the leading causes of death in Oregon, and that we know that early breast and cervical cancer screening saves lives, and I'm definitely encouraged by your interest in this issue and happy to answer any questions that you have.
Questions? Seeing none. And there, I have no one else signed up to testify, so I'd like to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 362, and I'd like to open a work session on Senate Bill 362.
Madam Chair, I move the -1 amendment, Senate Bill 362.
Senator Cruz moves the -1 amendments to Senate Bill 362. Do I have any discussion? I think the Dr. Gutelis. No, I said it wrong.
Sorry. Sorry.
I want to get it right. Gutelius, he explained it very well. So seeing no discussion, any opposition? So ordered.
I'm trying to move Senate Bill 362 as amended by the -1 amendment to the floor with a due pass recommendation and subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 362 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Do I hear any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Sandra
Hayward? Aye.
Senator Knapp?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Vice
Chair
Cruz?
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. And when it goes to the floor, Senator Rosenbaum,
they'll assign down. Now it's in your hands again, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Sure it is.
Yes.
Okay, did I close the work session on Senate Bill 362? And seeing nothing further on the agenda, I do want to remind you on Monday we are going to have a film called American Winter. It's an hour and a half. It's on homelessness, and the film was taken in East Multnomah County. And I would encourage all of you, if you can, to stay after our meeting for that.
But no popcorn, right?
We'll see if we can get something. All right.
That is which day?
Monday.
The 18th.
The 18th, President's Day. With that, we're adjourned.